Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another The One-Liner podcast, the first in this bleak post-election landscape in our condemnation. I am Scott Morris, and joining me today is Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
We have a bunch of films to talk about, so I suppose we should start talking about them. Yes, yes, let's do that. First on the agenda today is the big-budget action blockbuster Iron Man 2. Drew, what say you about this?
Now, what do you really say about Iron Man 2? If you've seen Iron Man, then probably all you need to know is that really it's more of the same, though not quite so good. And if you haven't seen Iron Man, then you really must watch it first before even considering Iron Man 2. A brief rundown of the plot, though, for those interested. Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr., is a billionaire and arms dealer who, having revealed himself to the world as Iron Man at the conclusion of the first film, finds himself summoned to appear before a Senate hearing as the US military wants his technological goodies. His competitor, Justin Hammer, played by the fella, you know, him, off the films.
Sam Rockwell?
No. Sam Rockwell. His competitor, Justin Hammer, played by Sam Rockwell, the military's biggest weapons contractor, also very much wants to get his hands on Tony's shiny playthings, which he attempts to do rather than by subpoenaing him, by joining forces with Ivan Vanko, played by the awesome Mickey Rourke, who's also known as Whiplash, the embittered son of a Russian physicist who used to work with Tony Stark's father. And things go on in terms of a revenge plot and a desire for one businessman to outdo another. Tony's a bit of an idiot hole. Then we find out he also happens to be dying as a side effect of the materials used as fuel in the miniaturised arc reactor in his chest. So what is keeping him alive is also killing him. Ooh, irony, man. S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Nick Fury wants to help Tony live so that Tony can join an outfit called the Avengers so that Tony can help save the world. Tony's a bit of an idiot hole again. And then he fixes his fuel problem by fiddling with a hologram for 30 seconds, all the while falling out with the people around him that should care about him. Yeah, well, that's basically it for the plot. Oh, first of all, Mickey Rourke's Whiplash is a very entertaining and compelling villain. Unfortunately, he's not given anything like enough screen time. You want more Mickey Rourke. The new Mickey Rourke that's been around since Sin City is more or less awesome. And unfortunately, he's not given quite enough time. He does get to star in the biggest set piece of the film, where he causes carnage in what claims to be Grand Prix, but presumably for legal reasons they can't actually call that. Looks like a Formula 3 race in Monaco.
I believe it's called the Fast Car Championships.
Yes. It's like Monaco Grand Prix Historique, I remember it saying. None of those cars look even vaguely like real Formula 1 cars, and it doesn't have Formula 1 anywhere with it, so they couldn't be bothered paying for the rights then. This set piece that anybody's seen a trailer will be at least vaguely familiar with. It's impressive, and it's probably the only point in the film that Tony Stark ever looks like he's in any way vulnerable, and that Whiplash might win. Unfortunately, for the rest of the film, there's no sense of peril, even allowing for the fact that being the type of film it is, we know that Iron Man's going to prevail. There's no real sense of danger for the rest of the film. Some scenes also suffer from the same problem Iron Man had in its finale. So like two CGI creations knocking seven bells out of each other, which it's quite difficult to care about. It is a lesser problem in the sequel though. I suspect that's probably because of the fights being on a more human scale than the battle in the last film between Iron Man and Jeff Bridges' Metal Behemoth. On the upside, it's still very entertaining. Robert Downey Jr. is as watchable and charismatic as ever, and he's ably assisted by Sam Rockwell and Mickey Rourke, though for my money it could do with more interaction between Stark and his scutters. There is a problem in that for the second half of the film, although I think perhaps I didn't feel it quite as much as you did from your comments after we saw it, Scott, that there's not an awful lot of action in the second half for an action film. There's quite a lot of standing around talking, but from halfway through the film to the finale, there's not a huge amount of action. It's still an enjoyable action film. It's funny. It's well made. If you like the first one, you'll certainly like this, although, again, probably less so. And if you haven't seen the first one, I wouldn't see this until you had. But it's recommended, nonetheless.
My main issue with it is I just never had the impression that very much was happening all the way through it. Maybe not so much the lack of action. I think what they were trying to do here is focus more on Stark's character, which isn't a bad thing, but it just doesn't seem to have anything particularly interesting going on in it. I mean, it's kind of focusing on a kind of self-destructive cycle and whatnot, but it's been tamed down for a kind of mass market where you can't really have him being seen as a vulnerable character for whatever reason, which goes right against the grain of the drama. I mean, the whole point of this war machine introduction thing in the comics was because Stark was an alcoholic and got to the point where he couldn't function, which would make a more interesting dramatic hook to the film, but not quite so kiddie friendly for the mass market audience. So it failed a bit kind of defanged. And of course, it was all solved by twiddling a few knobs. And they went, oh, right, better now. Okay, better have an anticlimactic CG fight in the set piece. Even with all that said, it's not bad exactly. I just felt that for an awful lot of the time, it was coasting on charm. You can get away with an awful lot if you've got Rockwell and Rourke and Downey Jr. just doing their shtick. And that helped it get through. And I wasn't really complaining about it. And I don't think it's a bad film, and it's enjoyable enough. But it just felt like it was a far lesser film than the first one. And
yeah.
I wouldn't go out of my way to recommend it. It's not that it's a bad film, but I just felt sort of on the kind of slightly good side of mediocre. There's maybe not much else out at the minute of this sort of thing that is comparable, so I suppose it's worth watching on that basis alone if you must go to the cinema and see some big budget, brash and bold and actiony. It's certainly far better choice than Clash of the Titans or anything like that was, but it's by no means best of breed. There's few comedians more controversial than Chris Morris, and for my money at least, few more successful. He definitely combines scathing media and social commentary with massively amusing absurdism, often with well-placed skewerings of celebrity culture at the same time, and he's the most far-sighted, prophetic, and made the most damnably funny comedies in the last 20 years. After the tabloid baiting of the last Brass Eye paedophilia special, the only surprising element of news to come lately was that when he decided to make a comedy about jihadi suicide bombers, was that he'd taken so long to come up with the idea. Nevertheless, Four Lines is now out, and in it, a character called Omar has seemingly had enough of this decadent Western culture, and he decides to go on a little jihad. When we meet him, he's already joined a terrorist cell of sorts. The nominal leader is the distinctly Caucasian Barry, a well-known and obvious crackpot. There's also Faisal, who's planning to strap explosives to his pet crow and use it to fly into tower blocks to kill, in his words, slags and Jews. Omar's brother, Waj, is going along for the ride, mainly because he's outsourced most of his decision-making to Omar on account of him being thicker than most short planks. Soon, it's apparent that Omar is the only member present with the merest hint of a clue about this sort of thing, although his performance at a Pakistani training camp proves that he's no Bin Laden himself. Returning with his tail between his legs, he nevertheless presses on with his own plan to activate the cell and strike a blow for radical Islam. Things progress about as well as you might expect from such a gang of idiots. Now, I'm going to try and avoid spoiling the gags, so you'll just have to trust me that it's massively funny. I'm backed up on this somewhat by the quality of the guys behind it, whether we're talking about Chris Morris himself or the additional writing team of Jesse Armstrong, Simon Blackwell and Sam Bain, collectively responsible for The Thick of It, In the Loop, Peep Show, and I think at this point we've pretty much completed the recent British comedy brilliance sweepstake. While it's obviously shot on a shoestring, it doesn't look tawdry, and the direction and comic performances from the entire cast more than hide this, with some exceptional delivery and timing on the lines. It's the lines themselves that shine, though, mixing the deadly serious with the absurd and fascinating, hilarious ways. I want desperately to stand here and quote them for the next half hour or so, but that wouldn't be fair to you, as my shonkily remembered rendition of them wouldn't be a patch on the real thing, and you really owe it to yourself to hear them in their full glory. While it's in the main concerning itself with the absurdity of people who want to blow themselves up for their personal equivalent of invisible space Jesus, it's important to recognise that this film is in no way racist. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It takes more than one jab at the institutional racism of the British police force and the complete failure of intelligence services, drawing parallels with the tragic Demenses shootings some years ago. If you're looking for things to be offended by, as most of the super fundamentalist religious fruit bats are, then you'll find something here to offend you, but only because you're blinded to the truths of how the world sees you, and indeed how you are. If you're in a camp that thinks that terrorism is no laughing matter, then I'm afraid you're looking at entirely the wrong film and entirely the wrong commentator. On a personal day-to-day level, the only way I have of fighting terrorism is to refuse to be terrorised by it, regardless of the gleefully inflated newspaper shifting hysteria around it. It's difficult to be terrorised of something when you're busy laughing at it, which is something that Chris Morris understands and utilises to great effect. I might even say that this is the film of the year so far. It's certainly the comedy of the year. Go and see it. Although, gratifyingly, from the first weekend's box office returns, it seems that a great many of you already have, but if you haven't, do so. Unequivocal enough for you?
That's fairly unequivocal. It's something I've maintained for a while, and I think perhaps Chris Morris, more than anybody else, has been the embodiment of it. Is that there's more or less, well, there is nothing in the world that you can't make fun of, that can't be subject for comedy, and this looks like he's just continued that trait he's managed in the past. This was shown at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and Armando Iannucci tweeted after having seen it, "I've just seen Chris Morris's Four Lions. Yes. Very yes." Correct?
Correct. Yes.
Was he correct? Rather than, was that what he said?
Yes, he was correct. Correctly, yes.
Good stuff.
My only possible additional comment would be more.
It just doesn't seem right. Craig's not saying that, though, does it?
No.
Next up, we have The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which, in terms of setup and plot, is a fairly simple film. Largely, two men have come up with a plan to abduct the daughter of a millionaire and hold her for ransom to get a payment in the millions of pounds. That's all there is to the setup, really. Although, as expected, with a film with only three people in it, there are obvious revelations and there's a great deal of interaction between the characters that turns out in a way you might not expect. It's certainly an interesting film. So, a very effective opening with no dialogue at all. We see the two men choosing tools and equipment, meticulously and carefully preparing, putting bolts on doors, fixing beds to floors, putting soundproofing in, and then they make the abduction of Alice. So effective and tense, though, is the opening that it's actually a real disappointment when Martin Compston speaks the film's first words. I know I've mentioned before that there are some revelations, this but that I can imagine you'd expect. I really don't want to talk too much about any specific event in the film, though. I knew absolutely nothing about this film going into the cinema, and I actually think that helped. I had no preconception about what to expect at all. It's the film itself. It's very Spartan. Very simple, bare sets, quite Spartan soundtrack. Not a huge amount of dialogue. Not a single extra or background character at all he's ever seen. It is just the three leads on screen. It means that more of your attention is focused on the actors, on the nuances of the performances, their facial expressions, and that is very, very successful, particularly given how good the performances are, most notably from the generally always excellent Eddie Marson. Marson really does excel as a methodical Vic with a suggested and believable undercurrent of mistrust and violence beneath his cool exterior. Martin Compston and Gemma Arterton also acquit themselves well. Arterton in particular stood out for me as she was given something considerably more substantial to get her teeth into than in previous films I've seen her in, notably Quantum of Solace and Clash of the Titans, and she makes a really good fist of it.
I can't really add an awful lot to that. It's a very effective film. It's not pleasant viewing, I suppose, but it's certainly effective. I was trying to think of good ways to sell this when you start with saying that there's only three characters in it, there's three actors and there's about as many locations. It starts to sound kind of worryingly Spartan, but it does manage to pull it off quite well. It's expertly paced. While I suppose there's only a limited number of permutations of plot that you could come up with for something with only that amount of characters and locations, but I certainly didn't really see what was coming before it came, because the performances were captivating enough that I wasn't really spending any time thinking about what was coming next. I was just enjoying what was in front of me. It's very effective, good performances all round. I'm pretty sure it's the first time I've seen Martin Compston since Sweet 16, moons ago.
Yeah, which he was very good in, but yeah, I've not seen him an awful lot since then myself.
It's good to see that he's all around, because he puts in a good performance there. I actually think it's Marson who's keeping the film together, though, that just the way he sort of swings between his initial sort of calm, composed, which is pretty terrifying in itself, but when it sort of bounces into maniacal rages as well later on, it's an effective performance. It's a hell of a character to for him to get his teeth into.
It's a film that I think you hate pretty much as I did, but the only upside to Mike Leigh's terrible thingy.
Atrocious happy-go-lucky.
Happy-go-lucky, thank you. So I couldn't remember the name of it because I knew that the name of the film had nothing to do with the content or how I felt at all. Happy-go-lucky, the only thing that came out of that with any merit was Eddie Marston's frankly terrifying performance as the maniacal taxi driver.
Mm-hmm.
He's always very, very watchable. And even in this, there are actually they've kidnapped somebody. They don't want her to see who kidnapped them. So they're wearing masks quite a lot. So all you can see is just their eyes through the mask. But even just the eyes of Martin Compson and Eddie Marston, they convey so much.
Yeah.
And it's partly the way it's shot, but a great deal about just how good they are at acting, that they can put so much similarly into their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a triumph. Just checking IMDb there. I have actually seen Martin Compton in more things since Sweet 16. But on the upside, they include The Damned United.
Mm-hmm.
And on the downside, they include Doomsday.
Yeah.
Yikes. Everything about the film is really minimal, but it very much works because everything is so concentrated and intense because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much everybody in it lives up to the demands that it puts on them as an actor.
It comes highly recommended. I found it a very effective little thriller, so yeah, definitely worth watching. Mamoru Oshii might not be the most recognisable directorial name unless you're moving in anime circles. If you are, then you'll probably recognise the name from Ghost in the Shell, 1995 seminal outing. It mixed up police investigations with top-drawer action scenes, brilliant animation, and a thought-provoking, introspectively themed plot that stood the test of time well, as any classic ought to. I've not actually seen an awful lot from him since, so I welcome the opportunity to slap eyes on The Skycrawlers, knowing little more of it than the director from which it came. Having watched it, I'm not convinced I know an awful lot more about it now, although to my immense surprise, it doesn't mean that I hate it. The plot is so Spartan that I'm not going to even attempt to relate most of it. Generally, there's a war on, waged in the skies with anachronistically dated-looking aircraft. The pilots of these craft are children, adolescents doomed never to grow up. When a new pilot flies into and reports for duty at a small airbase, it's apparent that there are secrets afoot. For him, it's the personnel on the base and their attitudes to him, and for the audience, it's getting a handle on the world that we're watching. For the most part, The Skycrawlers deals with exposition by completely ignoring it. There's a lot about the society that's glimpsed in news reports and outside visitors. The nature of the children and the battle that they're waging is never really fully explained. Critically, though, we're given enough hints and references and pointers to make up your own concept of the world over the course of 2 hours. Now, this might sound a bit like lazy storytelling, going by my hasty recap, but that's because I'm not a storyteller of the calibre of Oshii. The pacing and timing of these momentary fragments to piece together is such that by the time you've placed one of them in the jigsaw of the Skycrawler world, another's queued up ready for your attention. While there's a certain inescapable fact that for a two-hour film, next to nothing happens in it, at no point did I find it a boring or unenjoyable watch. The themes are not tremendously dissimilar from Ghost in the Shell, dealing with lofty concepts of what it means to be human and how you should live and how you should die, which is a bit of a stretch, you might think, but Oshii hasn't outreached his grasp. The Skycrawlers might not be the most exhilarating film to watch, but it's certainly the one that I've thought about for the longest after the credits have stopped rolling in quite some time. So where does this leave us? I'm awfully fond of The Skycrawlers, in largest part, I think, because it's one of the few films that treats its audience like intelligent grown-ups and doesn't spoon-feed everything to you. Without wanting to sound like an ivory tower elitist, that's probably the same reason why a lot of people might not like it. If you're not in the mood for basically piecing together your own interpretation of a film, this is not going to be the film for you. Indeed, even if you are, the barren, minimalist central plot stretched over 2 hours is going to be far too ponderously placed for an awful lot of people. Oshii's done a pretty good job of limiting his target audience with this film, but I'm certainly glad he chose to build it the way he has. I think it might wind up joining, or certainly on a personal level, having it join Ponyo as the animated representative in this film of the year list, although I recognise that I might be the only person that thinks that. I guess you pay your money and you take your chances, but I think this is a film worth taking a chance on.
Indeed so, I would agree. I am also vaguely annoyed because almost all of the notes I have written for this are more or less identical to everything you just said, including some of the vocabulary. That's most irritating. I was mentioning something you didn't know. First of all, just in terms of the style of the film, not similar from the way Ghost in the Shell looked, or mm-hmm. perhaps even the bizarre live-action anime Avalon that he did 9 years ago. It's a mix of computer-generated and hand-drawn animation, which lends the film a distinct but really quite pleasing visual style. Problems I have with it, though, are that much as I very much enjoyed it, as you say, not an awful lot happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I love being made to think by films, and I'm happy to piece stuff together. I think that it's gone just a little too far, though. Its universe is too opaque.
Mm-hmm.
And while much of the mystery and many of the conceits are unveiled by the end, though, as you said, you have to pay attention to newspapers on line tables and TV reports and playing in bars to fill in many of the pieces, for quite a lot of the running time, you're quite likely to be crying out for even a little exposition, just a little of the backstory of the film's world. It's some ponderous pacing, I think, lends itself well to its pondering of the futility of war and the replaceable young people who die fighting to serve the needs of those in charge far away, young people who never have the chance to develop a full life of their own and whose memories are hazy and indistinct due to the monotonous nature of their daily lives. An interesting point for discussion also raised regarding war as high-stakes sport and as a social service. One of the characters is suggesting that war is imperative for humans being human. I don't have too much more. I'll just be repeating what you said, Scott. Very much enjoyed it. One thing I do want to mention, though, is just, unfortunately, much as enjoyed it, it's guilty of one of my pet peeves, i.e. that of having a stinger after the end credits. If it's relevant to the story, which in this case it is, put it with the rest of the story. It drives me absolutely bloody crazy.
Yeah.
It's not like it's ever publicised either. It's never suggested by film promotions or anything that you stay for the duration of the credits. And unless you had good reason to, why would you? I mean, who does? Especially with the length of modern credits.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's just something that soured very slightly my experience of the film, because it's just adding that stupid thing in there. But it's enjoyable, and even, although not a great deal happens, when something does happen, for an animation, it's really quite impressive. There are a few very impressive large-scale aerial groups and some impressive dogfights that I actually would have liked to have seen more of.
Yeah,
they've done a good job with them, and that must have taken quite a long time to animate. So kudos to them for that. Yes, very much recommended for me too.
The visual style for me was a bit odd. There's points, I mean, the mix of 3D and 2D stuff is, when it worked, absolutely jaw-dropping, and when it didn't work, it looked like the first Resident Evil game on the PlayStation. There's a few points where it looks a little bit shonky, and it just doesn't look like they're on the same world, as the background and the foreground just doesn't match up in the slightest, but that's really rare, so I didn't really mention it. But other than that, yeah, the visual design's great. I like the character design's interesting. Everyone's sort of very featureless, which at first sort of threw me off until I realised that that's actually backing up the point that most of the rest of the themes are, which I suppose I can't really go into without spoiling it. But it's interesting how that all ties together, and it shows that there's been an awful lot of thought going into this and an awful lot of care.
A lot of work going into it, and it's about every aspect.
As I say, it's one of the few films that I've actually thought about in some detail after finishing it, even though, well, I suppose in great part because when you finish the film, you're still not exactly sure who's fighting, why they're fighting, or how they're fighting, or what the point of their fighting is, or why they're fighting at all. There's an awful lot of open questions for you to basically answer yourself, which I enjoy doing, although you're not given an awful lot of hints, but it's an enjoyable exercise nonetheless.
Okay, that's all from us for this podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions or any bones to pick, you can contact us by emailing us at podcast@theoneliner.com. And also, if you're not aware of it, we've done a few commentaries for films, something we intend producing more of. And if you'd like to get a hold of those, you can do so by going to our website or searching for The One Liner on the iTunes store, and they allow you to download them in an easy format to sync to your device of choice. And if you'd like to give any feedback on that, you can do so at the same address. So until next time, I've been Drew Tabdale, and Scott Morris has been Scott Morris, so I am led to believe.
I surely have. Goodbye. That didn't work so well.